The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're discussing evolution, and how Russian scientist Peter Kropotkin saw parallels between the natural world and his theories on politics and government. We'll talk to Dr. Lee Allen Dukatkin about his book, The Prince of Evolution, Peter Kropotkin's Adventures in Science and Politics. But first, let's learn how Charles Darwin's own writing is sometimes, less than honestly, used against him. I'm talking to Michael D. Barton. Michael became interested in the life of Charles Darwin, his work, and the reception to his ideas while he was a biology student in California. He completed a master's in the history of science at Montana State University in 2010, as well as worked on a project to transcribe the correspondence of the 19th century physicist John Tyndall, a prominent Darwin supporter. He now lives in Oregon and blogs about Darwin, evolution, and creationism at The Dispersal of Darwin, and writes another blog about sharing nature experiences in the Portland area with his young son. Thanks for being here, Michael.
Thank you for having me on, Desiree.
Now, I saw the presentation you gave at the Science Online 2010 conference in North Carolina on the misuse of Darwin's words. And I think before that, I hadn't quite realized how often his words were taken out of context. So thank you for trying to right the wrongs, sir.
Oh, very good.
So do you see this happen more often in specific circumstances, trying to bolster certain arguments, perhaps?
I've seen quote mining of Darwin's words increase in the years and around and in 2009. Which marked the bicentenary of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. Various creationist organizations and intelligent design think tank, Discovery Institute in Seattle, they're trying to show that Darwin was either critical or questioning his own ideas, or they're using Darwin for their own good, something that he said, which is kind of ironic.
Well, let's talk about some of the examples of what people say he said and what he actually said. Let me just read this out. To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. Now, Darwin did say that, correct?
That's an exact quote from On the Origin of Species. But what's important with this quote is the few sentences that come after it. And when you tend to see this quote used by creationists or other anti-evolutionists, they only give the snippet that you just read. If you were to continue on, yet reason tells me that if numerous gradations from a perfect and complex eye to one very imperfect and simple, each grade being useful to its possessor, can be shown to exist, if further that the eye does vary ever so slightly and the variations be inherited, which is certainly the case, and if any variation or modification in the organ be ever useful to an animal under changing conditions of life, then the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though insuperable by our imagination, can hardly be considered real. In Darwin's writing, all the time he is throwing out arguments against his ideas. He's foreshadowing how somebody could critique his ideas, and he's putting them in there, and then he's immediately giving a response to it. And a lot of quote mines are taken from just those points in his writing, but they will chop out his response. And this eye quote is interesting because it's probably the most well-known misuse of Darwin's words. It's in scores of creationist books, articles, on websites, and even I see it on social media. I respond a lot on Twitter to folks who are either quote mining Darwin or there's that one quote that's attributed to Darwin that talks about evolution, but it's not actually Darwin's words. It's become popular to use in business and industry books. And I always reply and link to a website that has quotes that are not Darwin's words, and it's from the Darwin Correspondence Project and stuff. But some people just don't seem to care. They like the quote, it works for their purposes, and it doesn't matter if it's truthful or not.
Well, how about this one? At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. So what do non-Darwin scholars say that Darwin is talking about there?
Anti-evolutionists will use this quote to show that Darwin is advocating mass slaughter of lower races of people across the globe and eugenics and genocide. But if you look at where this comes from, the descent of man, there's much more to it. The great break in the organic chain between man and his nearest allies, which cannot be bridged over by any extinct or living species, has often been advanced as a grave objection to the belief that man is descended from some lower form. But this objection will not appear of much weight to those who, from general reasons, believe in the general principle of evolution. But these breaks depend merely on the number of related forms which have become extinct. At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. At the same time, the anthropomorphous apes, as Professor Schaffhausen has remarked, will no doubt be exterminated. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man and a more civilized state, as we may hope, even than the Caucasian, and some ape as low as the baboon, instead of as now between the Negro or Australian and gorilla. So this comes from The Descent of Man, a chapter on the affinities and genealogy of man, a section on the absence of fossil connecting links. Darwin, he's living in the 19th century. He lives in Britain in a period of imperialism. He's making a statement of fact about what he's seen is happening across the globe, that imperialistic nations are going around and wiping some people out. That is not advocacy for that kind of action.
Didn't Darwin actually publicly speak against slavery and such?
He did. His experiences in South America during the voyage of the Beagle and witnessing slavery firsthand were very emotional for him. And there are some two Darwin historians, James Moore and Adrian Desmond, for the 2009 Bicentennial, published a book, Darwin's Sacred Cause. And they essentially make the case that in developing a theory of evolution based on common descent of ancestry for humankind, that Darwin was influenced by his and his family's hatred for slavery.
Okay, one more. And this is actually my favorite. A fair result can be obtained only by fully stating and balancing the facts and arguments on both sides of each question. So that seems like sound advice, but it's often used by people who want to teach the controversy, as it were. So what's the problem with this one?
Well, this also comes from The Origin of Species, and this quote was started being passed around, I saw online, in 2009 during the Darwin year. So they're using that because they want to say intelligent design should be on equal footing in the scientific community and people should support it. Where does it come from in On the Origin of Species? This abstract, which I now publish, must necessarily be imperfect. I cannot here give references and authorities for my several statements, and I must trust to the reader reposing some confidence in my accuracy. No doubt errors will have crept in, though I hope I have always been cautious in trusting to good authorities alone. I can here give only the general conclusions at which I have arrived, with a few facts and illustration, but which I hope in most cases will suffice. No one can feel more sensible than I do of the necessity of hereafter publishing in detail all the facts, with references, on which my conclusions have been grounded, and I hope in a future work to do this. For I am well aware that scarcely a single point is discussed in this volume on which facts cannot be adduced, often apparently leading to conclusions directly opposite to those at which I have arrived. A fair result can be obtained only by fully stating and balancing the facts and arguments on both sides of each question, semicolon, and this cannot possibly be done here. So Darwin's very aware that he's publishing a rushed version of his work. He can't offer every fact and conclusion.
As you said before, so this is about Darwin recognizing that there are criticisms and he's responding to them.
Exactly. He was not saying that every alleged theory has to be weighed before a fair scientific result can be reached. He was saying that he had many more facts in support of his theory, but he couldn't fit them all in the 500-page book, which people would have now in front of them.
It should go without saying, though, that the vast majority of people aren't going to go to the source documents every time that they read a Darwin quote.
No, they're not. But I think where what happens in this quote mining is somebody will be reading the quote, and if they see that a source is provided or a link is provided to the source, they'll trust that enough.
Right.
And won't go further. They'll say, oh, okay, well, they're providing the source, so this should be pretty legit. And this is what things like Google Book Search and Internet Archive and various other websites that put this stuff out there, this is where it comes in handy.
To leave things on an upbeat note, Darwin didn't say these things in these contexts, so that's positive.
It is. It is very positive. And I, even if people aren't being convinced and still reuse it, I still think it's important that we get it out there, we get it online. I see something, and I'm going to tackle it on my blog.
Well, Michael, thank you for what you do, and thanks for being here.
Well, thank you and for inviting me. And let me get one more thing in. Mm-hmm. Quote Mine Project. It's on the Talk Origins webpage. And basically, this is a site that has scores of quotes from not just Darwin, but biologists and paleontologists, and responses to where these quotes actually come from, showing how they're being dishonest in using them, and creationist literature that those quotes are actually used in. So it's a great website.
Perfect. And there's also a link to Michael Barton's blog, The Dispersal of Darwin, on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be back in a moment to talk to Dr. Lee Allen Dukatkin about his book, The Prince of Evolution, Peter Kropotkin's Adventures in Science and Politics. Stay tuned.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at speak73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest is Lee Allen Dukatkin. Lee is a professor and distinguished university scholar in the Department of Biology at the University of Louisville. His main area of research interest is in the evolution of social behavior, studying things like the evolution of cooperation, the evolution of aggression, and the interaction between genetic and cultural evolution. He's published 3 books on the evolution of cooperation, and his latest book is The Prince of Evolution, Peter Kropotkin's Adventures in Science and Politics. Thanks for being here, Lee.
It's my pleasure. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with you in the audience.
Well, let's start out with Peter Kropotkin pre-Siberia. Who was he?
Kropotkin grew up in a family that at one time truly were princes. But by the time Peter was born, they weren't official nobles any longer, but in fact, they lived as if they were. So he grew up in a household that had hundreds of serfs and everything that you could want in 19th century Russia. And his adventures really began when he was very young. So when he was about 8 years old, his parents are invited to a ball in honor of Tsar Nicholas's 25th anniversary in power. And Peter's not invited, but it turns out that one of the kids who was supposed to wear this very, very beautiful Persian prince costume can't make it. And Peter fits the costume beautifully. So he gets invited to come in this role of a little Persian prince. And the czar, for some reason or another, takes this intense liking to Peter. And in the middle of the ball, he tells the people around him, quote unquote, this is the kind of child you should bring me. And what he was basically saying was that he wanted somebody like Peter to be amongst the leaders in the next generation. And the way that that happened was you got put into the Corps of Pages that basically was trained to be the next generation of political and military leaders. And so even at 8 years old, Peter's parents are thrilled about this. They know that eventually this is what it means that he will be in that corps. And he gets trained by private tutors, speaks all these different languages, learns science, learns lots of history. And when he's 15, he gets invited officially to be in this corps. And he absolutely despises it. He's an intellectual even at that age, and all he wants to do really is read and learn about science and history and politics and poetry. And he's there because his parents, particularly his father, who was a very strict military disciplinarian, wanted him there. But he does have this sort of deep like for the Tsar, who by this time now is Alexander II, and talks about how he would give up his life for the Tsar and throw himself in front of a bullet if necessary. But two things happen to Peter when he's a page. He delves much more deeply into this fairly new ideas floating around on anarchy. And he's dabbled in this a little bit. One of his tutors when he was younger taught him a little bit about it. But now he begins to really read intensely about it. And the second thing is he begins to talk with his older brother, Sasha, who he idolized. And Sasha had introduced him to Darwin's ideas through the Origin of Species, and he and Sasha begin exchanging letters about evolutionary change. And so as he's reading about anarchy and as he's reading Darwin, he's becoming less and less enamored with Tsarist rule. And what really pushes him over the top in terms of turning his back on that kind of system is that Alexander freed the serfs, but in the end, Peter realized that they were probably worse off than they had been before, and that it was that all of the promises of freedom and potential prosperity that the serfs had been given were all lies in his eyes. And so at the end of his time in the Corps, he is already the sergeant, which means that he has the highest position. He's the top student. And the Tsar asks him what position he would like next. He could choose from anything he wanted in terms of a next stepping stone to power. And to his father's chagrin and to everybody's surprise, what he says is he wants to go off to Siberia. And the main reason he wanted to do this was he wanted to follow in the footsteps of some of his heroes like Darwin and Alexander Humboldt. And he thought that he could study natural history and he could also learn about burgeoning political movements if he could just sort of get far, far away from where the Tsar was. And he chose Siberia because it had been recently annexed and he knew that he could do both natural history and study burgeoning political ideas by going there, and he wouldn't be bothered very much. His appointment basically from the government was he was supposed to inspect prisons, which he did and eventually wrote a whole book on. But that's sort of how he got to Siberia.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Dr. Lee Allen DeGatkin, professor and distinguished university scholar in the Department of Biology at the University of Louisville and the author of The Prince of Evolution: Peter Kropotkin's Adventures in Science and Politics. So you described his trip to Siberia as a colder version of the HMS Beagle voyages. Tell us about that.
So he goes there when he's quite young, just a teenager, and he ends up spending 5 years in Siberia. And over the course of those 5 years, he literally crisscrosses Siberia for 50,000 miles back and forth and around and up and down. And most of it's on dog sled. Much of it is surviving on sort of the bare necessities, biscuits and when possible, teas and whatever he could carry around with him, going from peasant village to peasant village, from prison lockup to prison lockup, studying natural history along the way, describing himself on dog sleds in minus 40 degree weather. It was an incredible adventure and extraordinarily dangerous. I mean, there would be stories that he would tell of having to cross an icy river in the middle of the winter, and he needed some help from the local people. And everybody knew who was sent from the czarist government. And so he was somebody who they recognized as a person of power, even though he didn't really think of himself that way. And so sometimes he would try to do things like cross a freezing river, and the peasants would tell him that, you know, we're afraid to help you because if something happens to you when you cross that river, it could cause tremendous difficulties for our entire town if something happens to a person of power like you. And so he has these stories where basically he signs documents that say that if I drown when I'm crossing this river, it's not the peasant's fault. And he signs it Peter Kropotkin so that they can help him. Endless stories like this. Sometimes he has to go undercover using aliases. And all along, what he's doing is he's reading more and more about the philosophical positions of anarchists. And he is doing basic natural history work, both on studying animals and also on studying sort of the natural history of Siberian villages. And he's really very, very surprised at what he sees.
Now, he was comparing cooperation in humans to cooperation in nature by this point then?
The interesting thing is when he goes to Siberia, he is going there after reading and discussing The Origin of Species. And so what he expects to see is a sort of dog-eat-dog world where competition is the driving force behind everything. He goes there and he writes how he expects to see this. And no matter where he looks, he just doesn't find it in front of him. When he talks about what he sees in animals, he talks about animals forming groups to protect the young and the weak. He talks about animals huddling together for warmth. He talks about various species in which sentinels, individuals who sort of go on guard duty and watch out for predators, are present all the time. And so everywhere he looks, he sees what he calls mutual aid, but today we would call cooperation and altruism. And then he sees the same thing in the villages that he visits of Siberian peasants, essentially, except there he begins to notice an interesting correlate, which is that the farther they are away from the hands of government, the more cooperative they are, the more mutual aid they show. The closer they are to some sort of point of government, the less cooperation and mutual aid they display. And so he was beginning to just see this everywhere that he looked, in non-humans and humans.
So then he would have to, with his love of Darwin, he would have to try to reconcile Darwin's theory of natural selection with the cooperative efforts he saw in the people of Siberia.
Yeah, this was something that he struggled with for a long time. And when he was young, he had a great deal of difficulty doing it. What changed for him was when he got back after the 5 years in Siberia, there was a group of Russian biologists who were talking more and more about cooperation and mutual aid. And he joined this small camp of scientists. And there, what they basically said was that Darwin got the basics correct. It's just that his ideas were corrupted by particularly other Brits and essentially perverted into the notion that natural selection has to lead to intense competition and aggression. And they said that Darwin was perfectly correct, that natural selection was the force that shaped the life that we see around us, but that there was no reason that force would necessarily lead to competition and cooperation. It could just as well lead to mutual aid if mutual aid benefited all of the individuals in the community. And Peter and his cohorts believed that it absolutely did. And they thought that people like Thomas Malthus and other political philosophers who the Brits were quite fond of were just wrong, that cooperation was a rarity and that competition was what drove dynamics in all sorts of things. And without getting into too much micro detail, their basic argument was that Malthus and many of the Brits, they had experienced a world in which overpopulation was the problem. So if you actually look at where Darwin, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about Thomas Henry Huxley as we go along, where Huxley and Darwin and most of the Brits went when they did their natural history expeditions, it was pretty much to the tropics in South America. And there, life was teeming and flourishing. And when you saw it, you would often see various kinds of competition and aggression because there were just so many things competing for the resources. But that was a very, very different world from what the Russian natural historians and scientists were seeing when they went to places like Siberia, where underpopulation was sort of the driving force, not overpopulation. And they thought that underpopulation essentially created the selective pressures that forced animals to work together to compete, but not to compete against each other, but to compete against the harsh environment, the cold, and all of the things that they faced on a day-to-day basis in places like Siberia. So they held on to Darwin, and they said that the Brits who perverted Darwin's ideas were phony Darwinists, and that the Russian school of Darwin thinking was correct, that cooperation was what you would see, not competition and things like that.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with the author of The Prince of Evolution, Peter Kropotkin's Adventures in Science and Politics, Dr. Lee Allen Dugatkin. So post-Siberia, Kropotkin went back to university.
Again, despite what his father wanted, but he was old enough and had sort of risen, relatively speaking, in the power structure enough that he didn't really have to worry about what his father would say. So he goes back and he studies all sorts of things, including mathematics, and begins to get deeply involved with the anarchist movement that, is beginning to teem, particularly at places like the university. He takes a leave of absence and he goes to Switzerland, where the anarchist movement was really quite strong, and spends quite a bit of time with the Jura Foundation, which was the heart of much of the anarchist movement in Switzerland. And he's doing this. He's going over there. He's taking leaves of absence. And at the same time, he's an incredible person. He's studying mathematics. He's also already recognized as a leading geographer, because in addition to the natural history he did in Siberia, he did much, much work on geography, including understanding the ice ages and the orientation of the mountain ranges. While he was in college, he was elected the treasurer of the Russian Geological Society. He was translating Herbert Spencer's works from Russian into English, and he was thinking about the mutual aid that he saw in Siberia for his 5 years there, all of this as he's a student. But then things begin to get very, very nasty for Peter, because he is so deeply involved in the anarchist movement that he becomes fairly well known for his position there. And the Tsar and the Tsarist government clearly are quite worried about the anarchist movement, and eventually start hunting down anarchists, particularly these anarchists that were in a group called the Tchaikovsky Group, that not Tchaikovsky the musician, but Tchaikovsky the anarchist, that Peter had joined. And these people had a small little press that Peter wrote for all the time, and they would go out and they would work with people in a sort of one-to-one and small group basis, teaching them the ideas of anarchy, the political philosophy. And people were beginning to watch Peter and from the government, and they didn't like what they saw, and so they took some action.
The Tchaikovsky Circle, actually, one of the things that they did was really teach the peasants how to read.
That's right. And so initially, this group actually was quite skeptical about letting Peter in, because he did have nobility in his blood, and he was considerably older than many of the people that were in the Tchaikovsky group. But eventually they let him in because they began to see that his deep passion for things like teaching peasants to read and teaching them the basic idea of freedom, things that they just had never experienced before, simple medicine, things that could save people's lives that were really basic, that they had never been taught before. And the people in that circle began to realize that Peter really had a deep passion for this. And he loved the fact that they were teaching people to read. And he loved the fact that they had a small press, because he just was someone who had to write. It was just part of who he was. He wrote constantly. I mean, over the course of his life, he wrote an astounding number of books and letters and journals and pamphlets. And so he was particularly fond of that aspect of the Tchaikovsky Circle.
And of course, for his involvement in the circle, he was incarcerated.
They tracked him down and they brought him to the Peter and Paul prison, which was a very, very nasty place. It was where they sent people who were the most dangerous troublemakers. He was put into solitary confinement. And they tried to break him. He had no interaction with people. Eventually, he got some books allowed in, and he got actually some paper and pencil, because the Russian Geological Society made a pitch to the powers that be that Peter was still writing some important documents for them. And so he got a little bit of that, a little bit of paper, a little some writing utensils, some books, but otherwise he was completely cut off. And he did everything he could to keep his sanity. He would talk about these routines where he would every day he would try and keep himself healthy because he knew that he needed to do that. So he would walk a certain number of times back and forth across his cell every day, thousands of times, and measured it to the equivalent of miles. He would use tiny little pieces of furniture that were in his room to lift up and use as sort of exercise material. But despite that, he ended up getting probably scurvy or something like that. And he eventually gets put into the hospital part of the prison. And then while he's there, he realizes that if he's ever going to get out of there, it's going to be when he's at this part of the prison, because this is the place where the security, although very real, was a little bit lax, more lax than other places. And he begins to work with a few other people on breaking out. And they spend months going through the micro details of plans to get out of the prison. They change their ideas many, many times. So Peter, eventually, when he's in the hospital, he's allowed to go out about an hour a day to take a walk because the doctor said he would basically die if he didn't get the fresh air. And they let him out. And he sort of was scoping out the prison and ways to get out. And they come up with this incredibly elaborate plan that involves various people on the outside who are going to let go of a red balloon. And that's going to be the start of the prison escape. And the day that this is supposed to go down, there are no red balloons out. Every day in Moscow, there are people that sell red balloons. It's just part of the culture. And that day, there were no red balloons available. So the plan failed. They decide that they're going to try some other things, and it involves some folks who are sitting on the outside, and they're literally spitting cherry pits to one side or another as a way to convey information to other people on the plot about what's supposed to happen next. And then finally, the impetus to actually start the escape is somebody playing the violin, playing a particular piece. And Peter hears this piece, and he makes a break for it when he's out on his walk, and the guards are coming after him. He knew that they would, and he basically gets over the wall and gets out, and there's a carriage waiting for him, and the carriage takes him away. They escape, luckily, just barely. He makes it and hides out for a few days, gets a haircut and shaves himself so he doesn't look like he used to. The czar, they're after them. They're putting posters up everywhere. They were quite upset that, because by this time people knew who Kropotkin was, they were quite upset that this guy, this troublemaker, had escaped. Rumors started flying around that the driver of the carriage that took him away was actually the czar's brother, the Grand Duke, who was having this big rivalry with the czar. And it's probably not true that he drove the carriage that took Peter away. But these were the sorts of things that were in the air. And eventually Peter escapes, goes through various ports, and he ends up in England in 1888.
And in England, he goes to jail again, but when he comes out, he, I guess, basically becomes the sworn enemy of Thomas Henry Huxley.
Right. So he actually, it's not England that he goes to jail in again. It's actually France. And he does become the sworn enemy of a fellow named Thomas Henry Huxley. So Huxley is the founder of what today we think of as the Huxley dynasty. His grandson was Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. And there are many, many Huxleys that came from his lineage that are quite famous in England. But Thomas was the first of them. He was the face of Darwin's ideas on evolution. So Darwin was too ill and also didn't have a personality where he would basically go out to the public and talk about his ideas. But Thomas Henry Huxley loved to do this because, in part because he was certain that Darwin was right, and in part because he knew how much it annoyed people when he did this. And so he would go, and he became the face of Darwinism. And he was also quite an amazing scientist himself. And he went down to South America on a ship called the Rattlesnake, and he took his version of the Beagle trip. He comes back, and he also, in addition to being the face of Darwinism, he was Steve Gould, before he died, used to, I think he said that one of the nicest compliments he ever got was that people called him the Thomas Henry Huxley of modern times. I mean, so that's, Huxley was one of the first people who was really trying to reach the public in England with ideas on science. And one of his ideas was about evolution and cooperation. And you could not imagine a more diametrically opposed view of the world when it comes to cooperation than Huxley had when compared to Kropotkin. Kropotkin saw mutual aid and cooperation everywhere he looked, and Huxley saw the exact opposite. And he wrote this very, very famous essay called The Struggle for Existence, in which he lays out his ideas. This essay is in a magazine that was called 19th Century, and this was sort of the place that everybody who was anybody wrote, and everybody who was anybody read 19th Century. So in addition to like ex-prime ministers writing about politics in 19th Century, Beatrix Potter wrote some of her stories in 19th Century. It was the place for the intelligentsia, and Huxley wrote an essay in there, The Struggle for Existence, that was really an obituary to Darwin, who had just recently died. And in there, Huxley says that in no uncertain terms, that the animal world is on par with a gladiator stage, that the animals are all set, and when the thumbs are put down, they go at it and they kill each other because life is competition, natural selection leads to competition, and the only time you ever see what Kropotkin referred to as mutual aid was among family members. Kropotkin saw it everywhere, and it had nothing to do with family membership. Everyone was displaying mutual aid for Kropotkin. For Huxley, it was the opposite. It was virtually nowhere, and the only time it ever existed was among family members. And when he wrote this, Peter had just landed in England, and he saw Huxley's article, and he was just livid. Everything he had seen in Siberia suggested the opposite to him. And so he wrote a series of counter essays in the same journal, 19th Century, in which he laid out his ideas on mutual aid. And eventually those essays in 19th Century became his book, Mutual Aid, which he published at the turn of the 20th century, so I think it was 1902 that Mutual Aid came out, became an extraordinarily well-read book. But it all started, I don't know that Peter really would have written the essays that eventually became his book, Mutual Aid, unless he had read Huxley's article when he landed in England. He was just absolutely livid.
We have some email questions piling up. This is from Chloe.
Does Kropotkin's mutual aid hypothesis apply to all of evolution, or is it confined to creatures like apes that have some cognitive awareness of the needs of others?
For Kropotkin, it was absolutely not confined to other primates with what we might think of as sort of higher cognitive abilities. He saw it in everything you could imagine, from squirrels and ruminants that were running around the Siberian fields to fishes and birds and crabs and whatever you could imagine. Peter, when he saw it, saw them displaying some sort of mutual aid, either huddling together for warmth or helping get some food that they would then share, or protecting one another from a predator. And he even wrote this beautiful essay one time when he was in England. He went to one of the aquarium, and he was just mesmerized by this giant tank that was in front of him. And he tells this beautiful story about some of the hermit crabs that were in there, and one of them had sort of fallen over on its back and it couldn't flip itself over. And he goes on in this beautiful detail about how frustrated all the other crabs were that they couldn't help, and they kept trying and trying and trying, and finally they were able to flip him over. I had the chance to go to one of these, an archive that had much of Peter's writings in it, and in there you can find supplements that he wanted to add to his book Mutual Aid. And one of those supplements, he talks about cooperation among ants. If you look at the physiology and the anatomy of the ants, Peter thought that there were basically two things that were part of the physiology of the ant. There was sort of the stuff that was in an ant that was there for that individual, and the stuff that was in an ant that was there for all the other ants. These parts of its of digestive system that were essentially there to regurgitate food to other ants. And he would quote entomologists of the day to say that that part of the body was essentially part of the collective rather than, in a sense, part of that individual. So he saw it everywhere. Today, certainly a lot of the focus is on primates and other primates, but there is much work, some of it from my own lab, where people are studying cooperation in fish, cooperation, a lot of it in social insects, bees, ants, and wasps, and everything in between. But Peter certainly did not think it was limited to primates. It was everywhere.
Now, mutual aid is basically a cornerstone of anarchist thought, so maybe let's discuss that for a moment. When we think of anarchism now, I assume most of us tend to flash on images of young men in bandanas, perhaps, setting fire to cars.
Throwing rocks at right. the international banking meeting, yes.
Right. But right. that's not what Kropotkin was talking about. So maybe if you could just briefly sum up, what was anarchism to Kropotkin?
Anarchism was the lack of government. And for Peter, what that meant was that if you let small groups of individuals, and I'm using the word individuals rather than people because he thought it applied to non-humans as well. If you let them interact with each other outside the hand of government, that they naturally cooperate with each other and provide mutual aid to one another in terms of food, in terms of protection, in terms of whatever they need, that government was essentially the problem, not the solution. That when government came into being for all sorts of reasons, they suppressed mutual aid. And it was only when people would live in small to moderate groups and that animals would live in small to moderate groups that you would get the expression of mutual aid that he believed was sort of the natural state of all things. And that it was only suppressed when they were under the hand of some sort of government. I mean, it's, you know, you can't really demarcate Kropotkin's ideas on mutual aid and anarchy from his ideas on mutual aid and biological evolution. But I think you can make the strong argument that maybe what pushed him over the top in terms of making him a hardcore political anarchist was what he saw among animals in Siberia. And it basically was this, that there really wasn't anything remotely like a government or an elite strata that ruled in animal groups. And when Peter saw these animal groups, he saw them performing mutual aid to one another. At least that's what he thought he saw. And if they could do that in the absence of any kind of government oversight, then Peter believed this had to be sort of the primitive, primordial state, and that we humans could certainly benefit by learning that if we remove the shackles of government, and not just the shackles, but the existence of government, that we would see mutual aid manifest itself. And I mean, he wrote all these wonderful books in which he, one was called The Scientific Basis of Anarchy, in which he basically says that the political philosophy of anarchy is sort of the last phase of evolution, that these were all tied together for him. He talked about the law of mutual aid, and that law of mutual aid applied to politics as well as biological evolution.
We have a question from the chat. It's from Baruch Spinoza. Funny.
I've always wanted to talk to that person.
I know.
Okay. I've always wanted to meet Spinoza, so yes.
Kropotkin's thesis seems to parallel many of the Enlightenment philosophers and their notion of the social contract and how morality and cooperation are ultimately logical and will arise naturally, even without being imposed either by deity or monarchy. Do you see that similarity?
Oh, yes. And certainly, I mean, certainly Peter would have been aware, you know, he would have read many of the great Enlightenment thinkers. And so the connection is definitely real there, at least for, you know, for some of the Enlightenment thinkers, like the emailer says, people who talked about the social contract. I think Peter and those folks were right in line with each other. I think the big difference was that Peter was much more steeped in the biological end of it than others. It's not as if some of the Enlightenment thinkers weren't good biologists as well. But for Peter, what drove this, it wasn't so much the sort of pure logic behind it as it was for many thinkers in the Enlightenment that who realized that this is the natural consequence of logical processes. But for Peter, it was at the heart of all living things that this is what they did and that biology showed this. And of course, you know, Peter had the advantage of living after Darwin had published The Origin of Species. And so he was at quite an advantage compared to some of the people before that. And this is what drove him was initially the biological side, but certainly he was in line with many of the Enlightenment thinkers and social contract thinkers.
And we'll be right back with more on Peter Kropotkin, evolution, and human cooperation after this.
Oh.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we look back into prehistory for a glimpse of what life was like before humanity spread across the globe. We're joined by anthropologist and author Brian Fagan to discuss his book Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. And junior skeptic editor Daniel Loxton returns to discuss his new children's book Ankylosaur Attack, about a day in the life of this armored dinosaur. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today's guest is Lee Allen Dukatkin, professor and distinguished university scholar in the Department of Biology at the University of Louisville. Lee studies the evolution of social behavior, and his latest book is The Prince of Evolution, Peter Kropotkin's Adventures in Science and Politics. So apart from Huxley, we already know what he thought. What did other scientists think of Kropotkin's work?
At the time, Peter's work within biology was essentially seen through the lens of his argument with Thomas Henry Huxley. Most other people who knew Peter knew him as arguably the face of the anarchist movement after a while. And so he didn't draw tremendous amounts of attention from many in the biological community, except for things like, so they certainly knew about him. So, for example, when he was tossed into the French prison on sham charges, he was in France and he was an anarchist, and that was enough to throw him into prison for many, many years. There was a petition taken up by many, many famous people across Europe, and many of them were scientists. But, I mean, for them, they certainly knew of Peter's ideas on mutual aid. They knew about his work in geography, but it was more that he was just seen as this brilliant intellectual who spanned across many, many disciplines that made him most well known within the biological community. Later on, he took some other positions in biology that dealt with other aspects of evolution, particularly some ideas that a fellow named Lamarck, who predated Darwin, had. And he riled up some folks with those ideas. But for the most part, his biology fame was due to the kinds of arguments that he had with people like Huxley. And it was through his politics that everybody else knew him.
Was there any anger at bringing politics into the study of evolution, or maybe tainting evolution with politics?
You know, at this point, there really wasn't. At this point, the demarcation between science and politics was not really what it is today. And most of the people who were reading Kropotkin's work really were more politically oriented. And for them, it was sort of this enlightenment of the biological scientific side of things. And it wasn't so much the scientists who were reading his political work as it was the political thinkers who were reading his biology work that made him most well known. And so, you know, many people mixed together. I mean, if you look, for example, at that essay I mentioned that Huxley wrote that started the whole shebang with Kropotkin, the struggle for existence essay. I mean, I focused on the parts where he talked about the animal world as a dog-eat-dog fight. But the rest of the essay is on sort of what you might think of as a political philosophy statements about the way that government should run and what taxes are for and all of these other things. So Huxley certainly did the same sorts of things. It was only, I think, later that people began to concern themselves about sort of demarcating these disciplines. Spencer was another fellow who mixed them together. I think in their minds, the people who did this really understood the difference between scientific and political approaches. It's just that they didn't feel the need to sort of start off everything they wrote by saying, you know, I'm a biologist and I'm going to give you a biological view of what I'm going to write about. They didn't feel that they needed to do that. They were essentially going to take the broadest possible approach they could to these topics, and they didn't have to say, this is me political, this is me biological.
Oh, how times change.
Yes, certainly. Absolutely. I mean, you couldn't, and I think you probably wouldn't want to do that today. And there's good reason why you really do have to be careful about that sort of thing. But you have to be more careful about it today than you did in Peter's day.
Well, now, and I suppose to a certain degree then, there is the danger of bringing your bias into the science, isn't there?
I mean, absolutely. There's no question. There's a wonderful book called Darwin Without Malthus that was written by a science historian named Daniel Toews. And he makes this really beautiful, I think, correct argument that When you think about the two worldviews that we're really talking about here, sort of the Western European Huxley view of natural selection and evolution being driven by competition, and the more Eastern Russian view that cooperation was the key, you can't ignore the fact that these match very well with the political philosophies that are dominant in the societies in which you live. I mean, competition was the blood and soul of an Englishman at the time. And even in Kropotkin's day, although much of the work we're talking about was before even the earliest parts of the Russian Revolution, the competition capitalist philosophy of things was certainly primarily absent in Russia. And so the politics and the economics were completely entwined with the Eastern and Western views of science as well. And anytime you do that, you have to be careful. I mean, there's no doubt that Peter was moved in his political thinking by the way that he was certain biology worked. And there's no question that later in life, when he delved into other parts of biology, that his political philosophy of anarchy played a role in that. I mean, for him, those two things couldn't be separated. This law of mutual aid applied to everything. And that was sort of the whole point. It was that you have one basic idea of mutual aid that explains everything from what we see in animals to what we see in our own species in terms of how we lead ourselves and how we govern or don't govern ourselves.
So do you think that he was trying to justify his opinions with science, though, or have we seen more scientific evidence since then of what he was getting at?
One always has to realize that that's a possibility, that subjectivity is going to creep into whatever we do. I will say in Kropotkin's case that at least what we can say for certain is this, that when he went and began to study natural history, he expected to be the person who was going to essentially see the competition that everybody had described in England. And he was going to be the Russian scientist that was going to document this in Siberia. So he, when he began, if he was biased, it was biased the other way. For Peter, it was only what he observed in Siberia that made him convinced that while the idea of natural selection as a force was important, the way that it manifests itself was being incorrectly portrayed. And he began to think that it was, you know, one of his duties to show that. And so I think that while later on he certainly used biology to inform anarchist thinking, I don't think he would have thought of it as using science to justify politics as much as using science to explain politics, to tell people why certain political systems are more natural and more likely to promote goodness. In terms of the second part of the question, which is, well, what do we know today about things compared to what Peter said? I hate to say things like this because it always sounds wishy-washy, but I mean, there are strong elements of both what Huxley and Kropotkin talked about. I mean, there's just no question that natural selection often manifests itself in competition and aggression. What's happened in the last 40 to 50 years, though, is people have really come back to recognizing what Peter recognized in the 1880s, which is that although that's true, that competition and aggression are real, that cooperation and altruism and mutual aid are just as real. You know, I wouldn't want to put a number on, you know, the relative strength of these things, but they're both major, major forces. They both are the product of natural selection. And sometimes mutual aid and cooperation is simply a better solution in terms of natural selection acting as a force favoring one thing or another rather than competition. And when that happens, we see mutual aid and cooperation. And when aggression and competition provide more benefits, then we see that. So I think we see lots of both, although for a long time, I would say pretty much from about the turn of the 20th century, from about the early 1900s up to about 1950, people essentially ignored cooperation and mutual aid and altruism. And it was only in the 50s, more the 60s, that this began to surface again. And now we just know that it is, you know, you see it in social insects in particular. There are literally thousands of studies on cooperation in social insects. There are hundreds of studies in cooperation in birds, probably thousands, and many hundreds of studies in all sorts of other organisms. I think that the advances that we've made are that we understand the different paths that lead to cooperation much better than Peter did. He pretty much thought that groups that had more cooperators would do better than groups that had fewer cooperators. Today, that's a fairly contentious explanation for evolutionary biologists. We tend to think that there are other forces that lead to the mutual aid that Peter saw, but are more likely what brought species to mutual aid. And by that, I mean things like kinship. So Huxley was probably right that kinship was important, even though he didn't think altruism was real. And Kropotkin was right that altruism was real, but he significantly underestimated how important kinship, genetic kinship is. In addition, now we understand better that things like the exchange of acts of mutual aid are really important, that animals, and clearly humans, but more surprisingly animals, are capable of sort of keeping track of who's been good to them. And they're much more likely to help someone who's helped them in the past. And, you know, when you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, that makes some sense, that you would dispense your aid to individuals who have shown you that they'll give you help when right. you need it. So we're getting better at understanding sort of the theory. But Kropotkin was the one who laid out the big idea. I mean, he really was the first person to put the study of cooperation and mutual aid and altruism on the map. Darwin talked about it, but Kropotkin put it on the map. And we owe him a great debt, because there are many, many labs all over the world that specialize in this today, not just in biology, in anthropology and economics and political science. And all of them all owe a debt to Peter.
And we have time for one last question. It's from the chat.
Great.
From Sonic Squirrel.
I would be curious to hear about Mr. Doug Atkin's first introductions to the works of Kropotkin. Is there a particular work that stuck out to him and drew his interest?
That's a good question. I have been reading Kropotkin's work since, well, let's see, I began my own dissertation, which was on the evolution of cooperation, in 1988. And I found something really interesting, which was that many of the papers I read in sort of the hardcore evolutionary literature had a passing reference to Kropotkin in the first paragraph. They all sort of tipped their hat and said, oh, Kropotkin talked about this a long time ago, and then they never mentioned it again. I kept coming across this, and I kept thinking, you know, what is this Kropotkin work that everybody's talking about? And it was his book, Mutual Aid. And Mutual Aid is just a beautiful piece of work. It's the essays that he published in 19th century that were all put together, in which he has chapters on mutual aid in animals, and then he talks about mutual aid in human societies from the Middle Ages up to, for him, the present time, so the turn of the 20th century. And the book not only details mutual aid in non-humans and humans, but it's just so beautifully written. He was a wonderful writer. He tells these incredible stories, and it's so passionate. It's as if you're reading this person who's all of a sudden their eyes have been open, and they're seeing these connections that nobody ever saw between biological evolution and politics and philosophy. And that book made me just an incredible admirer of Kropotkin, his breadth of knowledge and the way that he brought things together. And basically for the last, whatever this is now, what is that, 24 years, I have been saying that someday I intend to write a book on this incredible person. Finally, that day has come. And it was a joy. I have to say, it was just a joy to write about him.
It was a wonderful book, Lee.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And we are completely out of time. So thank you very much for being here.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You can find links to Lee and his book, The Prince of Evolution, Peter Kropotkin's Adventures in Science and Politics, on our website. I have one quick news item. The amazing James Randi is coming to Edmonton. Randi has an international reputation as a magician and an escape artist, but today he's best known as the world's most tireless investigator and demystifier of paranormal and pseudoscientific claims. He's pursued psychic spoonbenders, exposed the dirty tricks of faith healers, investigated homeopathic water, and just generally been a thorn in the sides of those who try to pull the wool over the public's eyes. And for those of you who don't live in Edmonton, you might still be able to catch Randy at another point on his Cross Canada tour. Check the link that we will have posted at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if he's visiting your city. And since you're there already, do click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to archived episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.